that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Our roving producer and producer of Flashpoints in Espanol is Miguel Gavilan Molina. Our technical director is Mike Biggs. For more information about the show, to listen to or download archived episodes, log on to flashpoints.net or visit our SoundCloud page at soundcloud.com/flashpoints.
And it's 11 a.m. You're tuned to KBOO Portland, and it is time for the Radio Zine. Today's host is Ethan Scarl. He will be speaking with Dr. Jonathan Simon, and I'm going to let him tell you more. But first, I want to thank KBOO members for your generous support and remind you that if you are not a current member, you can become one. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today. And then I want you to hear these two messages. And after the messages, we'll go right to Ethan Scarl.
We are women recently released from Coffee Creek Correctional Facility, where we were in a program called the Family Preservation Project, which helped our children stay connected to us and taught us how to parent.
The Department of Correction chose to cancel the Family Preservation Project. Tune in to Prison Pipeline to hear how you can help us flip the switch on DOC's decision. Please support Senate Bill 939, which addresses the needs of children with incarcerated moms.
That's Prison Pipeline, June 22nd at 6:30 p.m.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Nepal Aid Concert, Saturday, June 20th at 7 p.m. at 4200 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. The event will feature live music by Manda and the Latin Sound Trio, poetry by Alex Dang, Nepali dance performances and lessons, and more. Again, that's the Nepal Aid Concert, Saturday, June 20th, 7 p.m. at 4200 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
It was 2007 in Memphis, Tennessee, at the National Conference for Media Reform, when I stumbled on a panel on the subversion of vote counting in America. It was a life-changing for me, even though unscheduled. I particularly remembered a fellow named Jonathan Simon with riveting tales of inconsistent screenshots off CNN and poll predictions suddenly failing. I became an activist for a while, until November 2008, when, like so many others, I was lulled into complacency by the Obama victories. And, you know, I actually knew better, but I didn't know where to go with it. And then late last year in Massachusetts, I heard a rebroadcast of Jonathan talking on KPFA. It made the hairs stand up on the back of my neck, and I discovered that he had written a definitive and current book, in my opinion, the best and most up-to-date book on the subject, called Code Red, which is available on Amazon and the website codered2014.com. And quickly decided that the best thing I could do for my country was to help promote this book. Now, Dr. Jonathan Simon is the executive director of the Election Defense Alliance. It's a nonprofit organization founded in 2006 to restore observable vote counting and election integrity as the basis of American democracy. As a result of his prior experience as a political survey research analyst in Washington, Dr. Simon became an early advocate for for an exit poll-based electoral burglar alarm system, independent of media and corporate control. The now, Dr. Simon has authored numerous papers in addition to this book and appeared on several movies, including Stealing America Vote by Vote and Uncounted, The New Math of American Elections, and dozens of live broadcasts. He's a graduate of Harvard College, New York University School of Law. Through fortunate coincidence and some forceful wrangling, we now have with us today Jonathan Simon. Jonathan, what's the situation with American elections now? Do we have a fundamental problem?
Thanks, Ethan, for having me. The real essential core problem with American elections is that we count our votes unobservably. It's not the only problem with American elections. There's big money, there's voter suppression, there's gerrymandering, there's the Electoral College. There are plenty of problems, but at the core is the vote counting process itself. And when you count votes unobservably, you really don't have a basis for trust in the electoral results. And the way I put that into an image or an analogy is the man behind the curtain. And if you were to hold an election of any size in which you handed your ballots, you made out your ballots, and you handed them to a man in a picture in a magician's costume who took them all behind a curtain, came out half hour later, said, "I've shredded them, I've counted them, and so-and-so won," you probably wouldn't have much basis for trust in that election. You could have been doing anything back there. Could have been paid off. If he was wearing a button that said so-and-so for president or so-and-so for dog catcher, there'd be even less reason to trust that process. And the real key here is that our computerized voting system, whether you vote on touch screens or you vote on optical scanners where you actually fill out a ballot and it goes through the optical scanner, they are really, in essence, no different from the man behind the curtain process. And those votes are counted in the pitch dark of cyberspace. And we'll discuss, I hope, you know, who is doing the counting. It's corporatized, it's privatized. And we are just expected to take on blind faith the results. And of course, we'll discuss some of the results and all their bizarreness.
It sounds like we might be vulnerable here in Oregon, even with our good paper mail-in ballot system, because the ballots are scanned by ES&S, computerized tabulation equipment. Do we know that elections have actually been stolen?
Well, what we have is we have copious forensic evidence, mountains of forensic evidence, dating back to the period when computers proliferated, and that was after the Help America Vote Act was passed. And you remember in the aftermath of the 2000 election and the hanging chads and all that, that was exploited masterfully by those who wanted to computerize American elections to really rush the computers into action. So by 2002, they were in place and they were doing the counting. From that point forward, we have all sorts of evidence, pattern evidence, statistical evidence. Red shift, what we call the red shift, is where the vote counts come out to the right of the exit polls or pre-election polls or any sort of baselines that we have, hand counts, prior election patterns, registration patterns, everything that would lead us to expect a certain result, and then you wind up with vote counts to the right of that. And I say redshift, theoretically you could have a blue shift where votes come out to the left, but we don't see that. We see this is virtually unidirectional. It is always or virtually always to the right, and we've seen it thousands and thousands of elections running. It's quite pervasive. We have other forms of evidence as well that I can get into that has to do with comparing competitive elections and non-competitive elections to look for targeting patterns. What I would say is that all of this evidence is what you, I guess, call circumstantial in the sense that it is not the proverbial smoking gun. And of course, even in criminal proceedings, very often circumstantial evidence is the best you're going to get. The smoking gun was destroyed or thrown in the river. In our case, we have no, and I mean we as citizens, have no access to the memory cards in the computers. We have no access to the code that runs on the computers, corporate communications about what's going on in the computers, or the actual ballots that were made out by the voters. And in fact, not only don't citizens have access to that material, which might reveal, it would be the smoking gun that would reveal some of these manipulations or, you know, suspected manipulations, but even election administrators have no access to this. This is all completely protected, proprietary corporate property. It's guarded like Fort Knox. So when we are asked to produce a smoking gun, the irony of that is it's kind of an inverted burden of proof. We're accepting the vote counting system on faith in an age that is known for its tendency to cheat, to deflate footballs, to take steroid injections, to run Ponzi schemes, to steal credit card numbers, et cetera, et cetera. And we're taking the highest stakes game of all completely on faith and being asked to prove that there is a problem when there is tremendous, tremendous evidence that there is that problem. And we have no access, we are given no access to the quote-unquote smoking gun evidence that would confirm it.
How did we ever come to accept such a system as this? Is it the HAVA, the Help America Vote Act, or how did that work? How did we get this in place?
That's a really good question. I mean, there was a panic after the 2000 election, and whether it was engineered that way or whether it was just exploited brilliantly is almost not, it's really not necessary to answer that. I mean, you could just take it as being exploited brilliantly to push this legislation through. And it was actually sponsored by Bob Ney, who was a Republican congressman from Ohio. And he later served, I believe, 30 months in jail for fraud and lying to investigators about election-related issues, about other issues, corruption-related issues. So he was the chief sponsor, and he and Mitch McConnell sort of got together and sold this to John Conyers, who was, of course, on the Democratic side of the fence, on the basis that it would increase turnout. And of course, the absurdity there is that the Republicans have done everything in their power to decrease turnout for basically the last century. They're certainly doing it in spades now. One should have smelled a rat there. I mean, this was very, very much a red flag. And yet they were able to secure Democratic cooperation, get the thing rushed through, and all of a sudden voting machines were computerized. You know, on a deeper level, our culture has fallen in love during the technological age with convenience, speed, expediency, things that look sleek. You know, there's no question that we've bought in to the high technology, which governs our lives. And you know, in many departments, there's a lot of pushback today about, you know, maybe it's not such a great idea to get your 2-year-old a smartphone, and maybe not everybody should be on social media or constantly searching Google. There's a lot of general cultural pushback, but very specifically, this mode of high technology, when applied to vote counting, is very specifically dangerous. And yet we embraced it without really thinking about what its vulnerabilities were. And of course, those vulnerabilities were very much there to be exploited. And the people that would have the motivation to exploit them certainly did think about what those vulnerabilities were, and, you know, how best to exploit them. And the evidence we have is that they've been exploiting them. And it has changed the course of our national direction. It's changed the course of history.
Where is the media in all this? Have they been doing their job at all?
Well, no. The mainstream media certainly hasn't. I mean, the mainstream media is not merely oblivious to this. They've been put on notice by many of my colleagues and people who work in this field. And they are more than oblivious. They're actively hostile. They've gone out of their way to write this off as a wild conspiracy theory, to refuse to examine evidence. And it's, you know, those of us who lived through Watergate and even further back to Edward R. Murrow, we maintain a soft spot for the media, you know, in our hearts. The media were the good guys, the media were the heroes, the media were the protectors of democracy. And of course, that has changed so radically. Most of the media today, certainly the mainstream media, is corporate owned, corporate run, corporate supported through advertising, if not direct ownership. And that even extends in many cases to the progressive media, which is very, very reluctant to marginalize itself by taking on causes that have been already marginalized or already written off conveniently as conspiracy theories. So the media in general has been very disappointing in this area. And it is very hard to get this message out, which is one of the reasons for my writing of Code Red. It was time, after 15 years or so of banging the head against the wall, to put this all together into a book that is digestible and, you know, it's not technical, it's not eye-glazing, and basically tells a story. You know, I often begin when I present in public, you know, with the line, "It was a dark and stormy night," because this is a story. There are many components to it. It's very... it can get very complex, but there's a common thread. And we have, and you know, as I see it, the common thread is that we have come to take democracy for granted. We were born into a democracy. All the people alive today who were born in America or in the Western world were born into democracies. And we just assume that democracies are self-sustaining. And of course, history tells us a very, very different story. Democracies are vulnerable and fragile, and there are always those who seek dominion, who seek to protect the people as their motive, or control the people through that protection, and take over and profit from it or enjoy the power from it. You know, it doesn't have to be Adolf Hitler. There's been a common thread of always movements to that distrust the people and distrust democracy, and look towards, you know, processes that end up in sharp inequalities or in slavery, actually. And those need to be beaten back if a democracy is going to survive. And one of the things that you have to do in a democracy is take care of business. And part of the business is the voting process. That is the bedrock protocol of a democracy. And we have a duty to that process and to work for that process. Instead, we wanted it easy. We believed that we could just outsource that to any old corporation. And that's been, you know, that's been the fundamental problem. And that really is not broadly enough or deeply enough appreciated. And that's where Code Red comes in, trying to build a foundation of awareness and get people inspire people to come back to the duties of democracy and to the work for democracy that needs to be done if we're going to maintain it.
I'm Ethan Scarl for KBOO, and we are speaking with Dr. Jonathan Simon, Executive Director of the Election Defense Alliance and author of a critical new book, Code Red. Jonathan, are you a conspiracy theorist? And are we going to... excuse me. Yeah, well, let's just ask that. Where are we as far as being a conspiracy theory?
Well, I mean, the term conspiracy theorist, I think, was a CIA-developed meme, and the idea was to be able to, you know, bat away very conveniently and with one wave of the hand, dismissively, anything threatening that was probing into the realities of the way things might be being run. And of course, history is replete with conspiracies right up to modern times. And not every conspiracy is a theory. Conspiracy is basically an undisclosed agreement to take some sort of action that, if it were disclosed, would provoke opposition, would provoke resistance. So we see that all the time. And in fact, we are, in a sense, conspiracy theorists because we're alleging that there is something going on below the surface, not being made public, that is having profound consequences for the public, and that if it were disclosed, would engage a lot of public opposition and public resistance. However, the dismissive aspect of the term, the pejorative aspect of the term, oh, you're just a conspiracy theorist, you know, you must be a get-a-lifer, you must not have anything better to do, is a broad brush that's applied to, you know, can be applied to almost anybody who's alleging anything. And unfortunately, it is possible to allege just about anything when it comes to human behavior. I mean, people are saying, well, we're walking around with chips in our head and we're getting microwave radiation that's controlling our choices, et cetera, et cetera. Probably not a whole lot of evidence for that. But again, that's a conspiracy theory. And the idea that memory cards in voting computers are being misprogrammed and malprogrammed to alter the results of elections, you can also term a conspiracy theory. However, we have a lot of evidence for the vulnerability. I mean, that's basically undisputed. The vulnerability has been really definitively established by the top level of the academic world, Johns Hopkins, Princeton, the states of Ohio, NYU and California did studies on this, the Brennan Center at NYU, the GAO, and they've all basically concluded that a single individual or a very small group can change the results of hundreds of elections through the programming process, either from the inside or by hacking into the system. And we all know today about hacking and, you know, how prevalent that is. So the vulnerability has been established. There's nothing conspiratorial about that. The fact that it's actually being done is demonstrated by forensic evidence and some of the outcomes. And that we have, you know, Code Red has a lot of material on that, a lot of papers that have been written, a lot of studies that have been done. We can go into more detail on that, but I certainly urge people to look at the book and digest it in that way. I think a very important thing to sort of cement this part of the discussion is people will often ask, well, if you were going to rig this election and you're saying the system is so vulnerable, you know, how would you do it? And there are many ways that you can program or hack into those memory cards in the computers. But I just give a very, very simple illustration. You could take a memory card, which has about somewhere between 500 and 700,000 lines of code on it, letting it know how to read the ballot and compute the results. It's a lot of code. And you introduce three additional lines of code interpolated into that big mass of code to reset the zero counters on the memory card. And what the zero counters are is it says, okay, when you put in your first ballot for candidate A, this is ballot number one. It's that simple. It just designates it as ballot number one. But in computers, there is no such thing as a fixed zero. You just have a lot of zeros and ones that are basically floating. So the first ballot could be designated as -253 or +4,600, anything. And so if you reset the zero counters from zero to -100 and +100, -100 for the guy you want to lose and +100 for the gal you want to win, at the end of the day, the ballots, the total number of ballots registered by that optical scanner or DRE will agree with the total number of voters recorded voting by the poll workers. Let's say one of those candidates gets 500 ballots and the other candidate gets 500 ballots, but you've offset the zero counters to -100 and +100. Remember, that just takes a couple of lines of code out of several hundred thousand lines of code. So at the end of the day, the +100 will show 600 ballots and the -100 will show 400 ballots. You've just shifted a net of 200 ballots per machine, per ward, by a trick that is essentially undetectable. It's undetectable in the first place because nobody gets to ever look at those memory cards, including election administrators. It's completely corporate property. It's also undetectable because it would take weeks and weeks of sifting through that code to find that little alteration. And in fact, you can put it in self-deleting code, and then you would never find it. So it's that simple, very, very straightforward, and you can turn a lot of elections around in that very, very simple way. An IT professional that once was interviewed for the movie Stealing America, his name was Chuck Herron, and he put it very succinctly. He said, it takes a long time to change 10,000 ballots by hand. It takes 3 seconds to do it in a computer. And actually, that was an overestimate. You can change more ballots in an even shorter period of time from the inside or with access to the networks on which many of these votes now are processed.
I would mention that there's a whole range of vulnerabilities here. Even if the source code is completely innocent, it's possible to have a corrupted compiler that inserts something like that into the object code where it's very hard to see. But if all this dirty laundry is going down, have there ever been any whistleblowers? Is anybody trying to tell us that they know what's going on?
There have been. Clint Curtis was one. Mike Connell was another, although a very reluctant one. And there have been some investigators as well. The problem with whistleblowers is it doesn't take much in the way of discouragement to kind of dry that up. And in Mike Connell's case, he met his doom in an aircraft, single pilot aircraft disaster. Literally weeks before he was scheduled to resume his testimony in a lawsuit that had been brought against Karl Rove and against Ken Blackwell in Ohio relative to the 2004 election. You know, Mike Connell was Karl Rove's IT guru, who basically set up the servers that were located in Chattanooga, Tennessee, to process the Ohio vote in 2004, where we got all those bizarre late votes coming when the evangelicals all came out in hordes to support President Bush after 5 p.m. Those were votes that were being sent to Tennessee and processed on Mike Connell's servers. So he was testifying about all that, and he was... he met his doom, died, killed in the midst of his testimony. It doesn't take many of those before whistleblowers get the message and don't come forward. The other thing about this is that it really doesn't take a vast cast of thousands to do this. It can be a very, very small group working from the inside with the corporations or hacking in. And so you don't have a large cast of potential whistleblowers. And the third point is that we've seen what happened to Bradley Manning and Edward Snowden, who is currently in exile, for coming forward with information that was disturbing and kind of tarnished the patina of American democracy. People were not treated as heroes. They were treated as criminals and treasonists. So it would take a tremendous amount of courage for a whistleblower to come out and essentially against interest and at great danger and peril to come forth with evidence about this.
Wow. So what about, is there any defense? What about polling? Pre-election polls, there's exit polls. How does that compare with the actual vote counts? Is there a story there?
Yeah, I mean, what we've seen in general, as I mentioned before, is this red shift, and that is that in elections that are competitive and significant, elections with national significance, we've seen repeatedly and pervasively a pattern where the vote counts come out to the right, 3%, 5%, 7%. Very often, because they're competitive elections, an outcome altering outcome, reversing result, coming out to the right of pre-election polls, of exit polls.
And don't people and notice? Hand counts. Don't people notice?
People notice, but exit polls have been discredited in this country as being, they must have just oversampled Democrats. So as being unreliable. Pre-election polls, again, I mean, you know, if you have faith in the vote counting system, that's your gold standard. And the pre-election polls must have been off. These pollsters must have been biased, or people lie to the pollsters. So there's all these very easy and convenient explanations to make for why all these other measures, other than these secret vote counts. So we're putting full faith in secret vote counts, and we're dismissing anything fundamentally that disagrees with them, including hand counts, including situations where some ballots are hand counted and some ballots are computer counted, and you see these great disparities. We had a big one in Massachusetts, my home state, in 2010, the special election when Senator Ted Kennedy had died, and his seat was being filled in a special election between Scott Brown, the Republican, and Martha Coakley, the Democrat. And it turned out that where votes were counted by hand, Massachusetts still does a fair amount of its vote counting by hand. So in the 71 towns in which vote counting was done by hand, Coakley won. And in the 280 towns where vote counting was done by computers, Scott Brown won, and the difference was rather enormous. I mean, he won by 5% in the op-scan towns. We used optical scanners, and Coakley won by almost 3% in the hand count towns. So it was an 8% disparity, which is actually huge when you're looking at that large a number of votes statewide. And it wasn't explained, and it was just, hey, you know, we were the ones who did the forensics. We pulled these numbers. We looked at them. And we said, well, okay, maybe the hand count towns were more Democratic. Well, they weren't. They were more Republican by registration. Then we looked at performance in prior elections, non-competitive elections, which are presumptively not targets for rigging. You're not going to reverse the outcome of an election where the margin is 40%, a non-competitive election. And we looked at those elections, and the two regions were congruent. There was no Democratic advantage in the hand count areas. We looked at Martha Coakley's previous races to see if there was a favorite daughter effect, that it was regional. Nope, absolutely not. She had done better in the op scans when she ran a non-competitive race for attorney general. We looked at media buys, in terms of media markets, to see if there was any effect for that. We basically ruled out quite painstakingly every benign explanation other than the means of counting, other than the way these votes were counted. And so that was a huge anomaly. It was begging for investigation. A very, very brief investigation started. One of the op scans, two of the op scans actually, were open in the town of Shrewsbury. Results were very egregious. There was huge discrepancies between the hand count, between the actual voter marked ballots in these op scans and the op scan numbers, and the investigation was shut down completely, and no other op scans were ever looked at. The ballots are now long since destroyed. So we have very strong forensic evidence along those lines. We've also done comparisons of competitive and non-competitive elections using polling, and this gets a little complicated, but polling the same set of respondents as a kind of parallel election to these competitive and non-competitive elections. With it, like, for instance, if the governorship in a given state was a competitive election, but the House in a certain district, let's say the 4th congressional district, was non-competitive, we'd poll in that district and we'd poll the same set of respondents. And what we found was that the disparities from the polls were much greater in the redshift direction in competitive elections. So where elections were non-competitive, we didn't see these disparities. That was pretty... very, very powerful evidence. I shouldn't say pretty. It was very powerful evidence that there was a rigging pattern, and it was being targeted, as you would logically expect, to competitive elections, where the elections were non-competitive, we didn't see that relative red shift. So there are a lot of means of going about this. There are other ones that are probably a little too detailed to discuss. But we do our work. I mean, we go after this and we approach it from a nonpartisan standpoint. We approach it from an empirical forensic standpoint. Let's look at this data. Let's see what comes out. Unfortunately, there's nothing nonpartisan about the patterns that keep emerging.
Well, so it sounds like the math of the statistics behind polling seemed to work pretty well up till computers were introduced, and then all of a sudden the math didn't work anymore. Now, by the way, this is Ethan. I'm Ethan Scarl for KBOO, and I'm speaking with Dr. Jonathan Simon, Executive Director of the Election Defense Alliance and author of Code Red. Different elections had different impact. Was there a particular, was it presidential years, or was an off year like 2010 perhaps particularly important?
Yeah, I just want to say the full title of the book is Code Red, Computerized Election Theft and the New American Century, and it's now in a post 2014 edition that takes in the very, very red-flagged 2014 election. And, you know, again, the presidential emphasis is part of why we're having such a problem here, because the media and the public, by and large, focus 90% of their attention on the presidential race. And in fact, if you want to take over the country, if you want to stage what amounts to a rolling political coup, you're going to want to take over the infrastructure of American politics. You're going to want to take over stuff that is more enduring than the presidency. So your focus is going to be on the House of Representatives. Your focus is going to be on state legislatures. These are, comparatively speaking, down ballot races. They're not exit polled. There's very little scrutiny. It's very difficult to do forensics. All we can do is look at these bizarre aggregate patterns, and sometimes we can drill down a bit into the pattern. But if we look at, you know, this computerized election age dating from 2002, it's really the midterm elections and the down ballot, the lower would seem to be lower significance elections that have been it certainly appears to be the ones that have been targeted. So you know, an election like 2010, tremendous turnaround in the House of Representatives, unprecedented. Based on there was actually a net shift of 128 seats, based on a very pedestrian, a very modest overall vote aggregate margin of votes nationwide. So all these close races, what that translates to is all these close races were going to the right, going to the Republicans. And 2010 was a huge watershed election because it preceded the decennial census where the redistricting was done. So by taking over the House and all these state houses in 2010, it enabled the Republicans to pass redistricting legislation, these gerrymandering is, you know, how we know it, that locked in all these gains. So, for instance, you have a state like Pennsylvania that has 18 congressional seats in the U.S. House. The Democrats won the aggregate vote for House in the state of Pennsylvania, and they wound up winning 5 out of the 18 seats. So the Republicans lost the aggregate vote and came out with 13 of the 18 seats. We're seeing that pattern repeated. That's the power of gerrymandering, probably assisted by the power of election manipulation. This has all added up to a situation where the U.S. House and the vast majority of state houses, state legislatures, the Republicans hold 68 out of the 98 state legislative branches. They hold a big majority of the governorships, 31 of the governorships, they hold trifecta control, meaning both houses of the legislature and the governorship, in 23 states to the Democrats' 7. They have control of the infrastructure of American politics, and they're using it to lock in their gains, to gerrymander ruthlessly. It can now be done with great effect because of computerization. They know they can practically go house by house. And the idea of gerrymandering is you take, you know, your opponent's voters and you stick them all in one district. So they win that district, you know, 95-5. And then you just have modest majorities, or certainly within rigging distance, minorities. You have 47% or 52% in all the other districts. And so you get all this bang for your buck for the same number of voters. And that has been done ruthlessly. Voter ID laws have been passed to reduce turnout among the constituencies that most likely vote Democratic: students, minorities, renters, older people, transients, et cetera, et cetera. Of course, passing, you know, gutting campaign finance laws, Citizens United, bringing in big corporate money is another factor. So that infrastructural takeover is really what escaped notice, because everybody was looking at presidential elections and, well, Obama won, everything must be fine. And in fact, even in the presidential election of 2008, there was a big red shift, even though Obama won. There were very significant 11th hour developments, i.e. the crash of the economy a day after McCain had pronounced the economy strong and vibrant, that changed the dynamics of that election after the time had passed for installing and deploying these tainted memory cards. So, you know, even though Obama won, there are questions about that election. 2012 was a very interesting election, which we unfortunately don't think have the time to go into, but it was basically a what looks like a cyber war. You know, there was the white hats and the black hats fighting it out in cyberspace. You had the group Anonymous in there, you had Karl Rove and his operatives in there. The system is that vulnerable. I mean, this is, you know, we have to ask ourselves, is this the system that we want to rely on? Is this what we're handing down to our children? Is this what we want to determine our present and our future and our history? You know, where it's, may the best rigger win. We can't have a system that's that vulnerable. We can't have a system that where the votes are counted unobservably and expect to maintain our democracy. We need a system where the votes are counted observably. And that would either be through hand counting of the paper ballots, or having the kind of well-designed and scrupulously executed audits that allow, it's kind of a quasi-observable process. It's not the best, but it's adequate. It should be adequate if the audits are well-designed to act as a deterrent. But it's not enough to have that process in a state like California or Massachusetts or Oregon. That process has to be national, because right now places like Oregon and Massachusetts and California are the outliers, and states like Wisconsin and Michigan and Ohio and Florida and Texas and Virginia and Iowa, these are the states that are controlling the national direction. And most of these states have virtually no element of observability to their vote counting processes. And not coincidentally, these are the states which have shockingly veered dramatically to the right. Scott Walker in Wisconsin, Rick Scott in Florida, and all those state legislatures. And for what it's worth, I have to mention the election of 2014. This was an off-year election. The congressional approval rating going into those midterms was, depending on who was doing the measuring, somewhere between 6% and 8%. That's when you ask people, do you approve of the job that Congress is doing? 6% would say yes, 89% would say no. You could probably ask about Saddam Hussein or Adolf Hitler or Osama bin Laden and get higher approval ratings than that in this country. It's almost impossible to get that low an approval rating. And also, for the first time, we had a situation where people said their own representatives, a plurality of people said their own representatives did not deserve re-election. We had never seen that before. This all began when the Republicans took over the House in 2010 and Congress began acting as, you know, anything but, you know, anything Obama says, we're going to fight, we're going to turn, you know, not constructively for the well-being of the country, but to establish political dominance. And as of the spring of 2011, approval ratings for Congress went down from the 20s and 30s into the single digits, stayed that way, and were never lower than approaching the 2014 election. So we go into 2014, and you would think that would be the foundation for great turnover, for great throw the bums out, this is not acceptable. And instead, we had 222 incumbent Republicans in the House. And of those 222 in the election of 2014, how many lost their seats? Two, exactly two. The Republicans gained seats in the House. They took over the Senate. They gained seats in state legislatures. When the approval at all these levels was at historic lows, this is an anomaly that is an absolute blazing red flag. It makes no sense. We looked at it. It could not be explained in full by gerrymandering, big money, and voter suppression all put together. The quick word on election 2014 is, well, we guess the Democrats didn't turn out to vote. Well, if the Democrats didn't turn out to vote, who then approved and passed all these issue agendas, all these state ballot initiatives and referenda for things from medical marijuana, protection of the environment, control of gun possession, et cetera, et cetera.
Gay marriage.
Yeah. All these progressive agendas passed by wide, wide margins. As a matter of fact, margins that were too wide to be riggable without, again, you know, failing the smell test. And these were passed by the very same voters who seem to be very happy to put back into office the very Republican and right-wing politicians who made it a core of their campaigns to oppose these initiatives. This makes absolutely no sense unless you look at the vote counting process and say, well, there was an invisible hand here. There was something, amiss. And certainly, I mean, if we haven't proved it in a court of law, we'd certainly get an indictment by the grand jury that would say, we must investigate this system thoroughly. We must look at this secret vote counting process. We must make sure that we do not rely on it to count a single election going forward because it is fundamentally vulnerable, fundamentally untrustworthy, and there is all this evidence that that vulnerability is actually being exploited to change the direction of the country. And I mean, I think the most outrageous thing is that history itself, our future, our children's future, could possibly be subject to such a cheap trick. I mean, it's one thing if you win fair and square. It's one thing if you win by spending more money or campaigning more intelligently or any of those means, any of those overt means. Okay, that's politics. But pulling an ace out of your sleeve, I mean, if a poker player did that, he'd be shot.
This is Ethan Scarl for KABU, and we're speaking with Dr. Jonathan Simon. He's the executive director of the Election Defense Alliance, based in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and author of the definitive book, Code Red. Now, I signed a petition the other day asking Republican governors to block legislation which would elect their state's presidential electors for the Electoral College, that elect them by congressional district instead of the current winner-take-all strategy. It sounds like that might be fairer to have some local variance instead of winner-take-all, which led to the Bush. Is that a good idea?
It does on the surface sound a lot fairer. I mean, a winner-take-all system is always leaving a fair portion of the voting populace feeling disempowered, disenfranchised. And it would be fairer, except for the fact that this proposed legislation in states like Wisconsin and Ohio and Michigan, these crucial swing states, is being proposed by Republicans, by ALEC, as a matter of fact, and the sort of Republican legislative template organization that's basically funded by the Koch brothers. with a very cynical goal of making sure there's never another Democratic president. And the way it works is that these congressional districts have already been gerrymandered by those Republican legislatures, so that they, to the tremendous advantage of the Republicans. So you take these presidential blue states, and by presidential blue state, I mean states that often, if not always, go for the Democratic candidate for presidency. And remember, you know, presidential elections have the higher, generally the higher turnout and more Democratic voters, et cetera, et cetera. And you take these presidential blue states where you might get, let's say, 14 electoral votes in the Democratic column, and you turn it over to the gerrymander process and you go by congressional district. Well, the Republicans probably control, like in a state like Pennsylvania, they control 13 of the 18 congressional districts. That's the way they've been gerrymandered and redistricted. So now instead of having 18 votes in the electoral votes in the Democrats column, you'd have 13 of the 18 votes in the Republican column. That's a huge, huge numerical exchange of electoral votes. And basically the impact of this legislation, whether abstractly you'd think of it as more fair or not, the impact is to make it essentially impossible to elect a Democratic president, and that's the goal behind it. So no, it is not fair. Having a national popular vote, on the other hand, where it's just the popular vote for presidency that, you know, for the president that would be honored, that would be more fair. Of course, it would take a lot of all the winner take all out of the process state by state. The problem with that is that unless we change the means of vote counting in this country, it actually makes it somewhat easier for putative vote count riggers to do their work, because now they can take their votes from anywhere in the country. Currently, the states that matter, because of our electoral college system, you know, you might have 6, 7, 8 swing states in a given election. That's where they have to take the votes in order to reverse the outcome of the presidential election. And so there can at least be a little bit of heightened scrutiny on states like Ohio and Wisconsin and Florida, et cetera, et cetera. If you can take your votes from anywhere, it makes it harder for the people tracking this and doing forensics to cover it. It basically lowers the deterrence to rigging. And I want to also mention that, you know, the algorithm for rigging, and this is, I think, very helpful when people are looking in and saying, well, why did, you know, so-and-so win this election if it's rigged? Why did Obama win, you know, this 2008, 2012, or why did this person win this congressional seat? The algorithm for rigging, when you go in to change this, the results and change the course of history, is not win every election. It's exactly this. It's to maximize your winnings and minimize your losses within the bounds of acceptable risk. And that's very important, within the bounds of acceptable risk. It's a pretty important calculation. How much scrutiny there is, what the margins of the races are, what you need to win, these all factor in into this decision about what to manipulate. So you see manipulation patterns that are quite by design low risk, down ballot races, very close races, where it's very hard to expose. And in the very, 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 very few cases where there is actually a recount undertaken or a red flag has been raised and an investigation goes on, you know, if the incentive to rig an election is X, the incentive to cover that and prevent exposure of the rigging enterprise once an investigation or a recount is launched has got to be 1,000x. So at that point, you pull out all the stops. And we've seen this in recounts such as the Wisconsin recount of the Supreme Court, state Supreme Court race up there, where the recount itself, I mean, was worse than the election. I mean, you're looking at ripped open ballot bags. You're looking at all sorts of evidence of swapping out of ballots, you know, to match the machine counts. And so the recounts are extremely rare. I should say that, if you feel secure about having paper ballots and being counted by optical scanners, forget it, because the optical scanners are virtually never, and I mean virtually never, opened. You cannot look at those ballots. They will never be examined. Yes, they exist in theory, but they are not open to public inspection. They're almost never open to election administrators to inspect. They, for all intents and purposes, might as well be invisible. There is exactly one county in the United States, it's Columbia County in New York, where the Republican and Democratic commissioners of elections in that county have agreed after the election to open their op scans and actually count the ballots. One, and they have received no support. The state administration is trying to shut them down. And their colleagues in the other counties, with the possible exception of Nassau County in New York, but the other 66 or 67 counties are absolutely hostile to what they're doing. They do not want to look inside the sausage.
And well, the Democrats are the big losers here. Why aren't they all over this? What's going on?
The Democrats are not the big losers here. The big losers here is the disenfranchised and falsely represented people of America, the American public. The Democrats, you can look at them and say, well, you know, poor this guy or that gal, they lost an election. But the ones that are in office have, of course, been elected. The electoral system has worked for them. They're not very excited about jeopardizing their careers. The ones who have lost are very much not excited about appearing as sore losers, which can be the death knell for any political career. I mean, look at poor Al Gore. He was the winner of the popular vote in the 2000 election, and he was pilloried for holding up the machinery of government, leaving us vulnerable to all sorts of national disasters and whatnot, where Bush had quote-unquote won Florida by 537 votes, and Gore had won the national popular vote by over 500,000 votes. So it takes, it would take great courage from a Democratic loser of an election. The party itself has very, very little interest. They are established as part of the political duopoly in this country, whether they're majority or minority. They have their place. They have their seats. They are funded and supported by the corporations. It really is going to take the people to rise up. And on that score, I have to say, my intent in Code Red is to bring this to the people. Of course, I want influentials to read it and spread the word. But fundamentally, it has to be come from the people and come from a foundation of popular awareness and determination and tenacity and willingness to say, look, this is our democracy. We are willing to invest in this democracy. We are willing to participate in the vote counting process. We are willing to be counters and observers and work for our democracy. Vote counting by hand is done in quite a few countries. Ireland does it, Canada does it, Australia does it, Germany in part does it, England does it. It can be done. It's not expensive. As a matter of fact, the machines, with their constant obsolescence and maintenance flaws, are way more expensive. It's a Luddite notion, of course. You know, how can we possibly go back from the iPad 12 to the idea of counting votes? Well, we're learning that all this technology is not all a blessing, and we have to recognize that we have to choose area by area where it works for us and where it works against us. And vote counting is an area where it has been shown very clearly to be a danger and to be working against us. We have to be willing. So I'm hoping that people will obviously get a hold of Code Red, because it tells the story and it tells it probably better than I've been able to do it here. And not only just get a hold of it, but pass it on. I mean, if you find it compelling, get some copies, give it to your friends, ruin their days, do whatever it takes to begin to build this foundation, because without it, the political system has shown itself to be non-responsive. It will continue to be non-responsive. So the idea is, it's at codered2014.com. It's on Amazon. It does, I think, work quite well as a vehicle for spreading this awareness and spreading this determination. And that's what we're going to need if we're going to turn this around and begin to count our votes observably in this country in a way that our elections can begin to recover from this scourge and begin to reverse the rolling coup, which has characterized the last dozen or so years.
Okay, so if enough people get excited enough and if the message becomes widespread, maybe there is some hope that we can restore and salvage our democracy. Okay, this is Ethan Scarl, and we've been talking with Dr. Jonathan Simon, Executive Director of the Election Defense Alliance in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and author of Code Red, again, available on Amazon or Code Red 2014-2014.com. Thank you.
Thanks, Ethan.
And that concludes this morning's radio zine. Stay tuned now for noon headlines, and that will be followed, as always, on Friday afternoon by Moving On. Don's in the studio getting ready to go. We are here at KBOO Portland, so keep it tuned.
It's time for the KBOO News at Noon for Friday, June 19th. For KBOO News, I'm Kristen Yount. The last time anyone saw an Eastern cougar was 80 years ago by a hunter in Maine who killed it. The cat, which measured 6 to 8 feet long, will at long last be removed from the endangered and protected list to the list of animals that have become extinct. Big cats like puma, panther, and mountain lion used to be the most widely distributed land mammal in the world. In Florida, there are less than 100 panthers left. Grocery workers at Food Front Food Cooperative voted to join the United Food and Communications Union, Local 555. The member-owned co-op dismantled their former union representation with the U.